Richard, and as you've said, my topic this evening is growth, productivity and employment, and it is the comparison of productivity figures for the US, continental Europe, and I'm going to focus on Germany and France and the UK, and the links between productivity levels, growth rates and levels of employment. Now, this is, of course, not a new subject. Indeed, it is extremely well-trodden ground. It is well-trodden ground in terms of the figure work, and I've therefore not attempted any new basic research for this lecture, drawing my figures entirely from Mary O'Mahony's excellent study published by the National Institute for Economic and Social Research. And it's also well-trodden ground in terms of points of view, of polemics, with, I think, broadly two schools of thought. A broadly left-of-centre school, which focuses on the supposedly superior performance of Germany and France, or other continental countries, and urges us to copy their higher levels of investment and higher levels of skills. Will Hutton's The State We're In is a sort of classic statement of that proposition. And then on the other side, you have an ultra-liberal or neoliberal or whatever you like school, which focuses on the supposedly superior performance of the US and urges further market liberalization as the route to match that superiority. And the McKinsey report on productivity presented last year falls broadly into that camp. Now, my purpose this evening is to throw some light on that controversy. And my essential messages are going to be twofold. First, that to throw such light, we need to be far more explicit than most commentators have been about the conceptual framework, about what different measures mean, which measures we should treat as maximums and which not, and why. For I think polemicists on either side have tended to approach this issue by highlighting the measure that proves their case, rather than making plain the fact that there is no single inherent absolute measure of success. That's point one. Second point, that the more you look at the issue, the more one is aware of trade-offs, of the social choices inherent in any debate about productivity, growth, and employment, and that the economist's task in this area is to illuminate the existence of those social choices and to distinguish clearly between concepts and measures of absolute efficiency, which should always be maximized, and measures which involve social choice, where trade-offs need to be made, need to be debated, and should be debated explicitly. To make those points, I would like to do four things. First, to clarify measures. What are we trying to maximize and why? Which measures imply social choice trade-offs, which not? Two, against that clearer conceptual framework, to set out the facts of relative performance according to different measures. Three, to suggest at least some of the explanation for the differences in performance that we observe. And four, to suggest some definite so what's for British policy and some open questions. Equally, however, I would like to say at the beginning that there are many issues of great and, I think, increasing relevance to productivity trends and improvement, which I will not cover, but which I know are important to cover. And in particular, the complex issues about how we measure productivity in services, and whether indeed our ability to talk meaningfully about productivity is breaking down as a result of the rise of the service economy, and the equally important issue about how we measure investment in a world where investment in economic terms, such as software, training, brand building and R&D, is in accounting terms expensed, so that the measures of investment in either company accounts or national accounts bear an increasingly unclear relationship to total economic investment. Those are vitally important issues. They are issues which threaten to reduce the validity of some of the analysis possible from conventional measures of productivity, but I don't think they undermine it entirely, and I certainly hope not, because otherwise the whole of the rest of the lecture won't prove anything. First then, clarifying measures. Let's begin with a basic question. What are we trying to measure? What are we trying to maximise? Well, one possible measure is output per hour worked, a measure on which the continentalists, as I might call them, are very happy to focus, since on that basis, output per hour worked, France and Germany do very well, well ahead of the UK, and indeed ahead of the US at the total economy level, similar to the US, Germany slightly ahead, France a bit behind, for the market sector level alone. And clearly, GDP per hour worked is not a silly measure, since we presumably want maximum output for minimum labour input, a maximum income for minimum hours worked. Not a bad measure, it would seem, therefore, of absolute efficiency or prosperity at any given point of time. But it's also clear that there are problems with this measure, and the Americanists reply with two objections, both somewhat valid, but both also more complex than the Americanists sometimes suggest. Objection one is simply that you can swell labour productivity per hour worked or per person employed by having a low level of labour utilisation, a proposition illustrated by some simple geometry. On the vertical axis, output per unit of labour employed. On the horizontal, units of labour ranked by declining order of productivity, a function presumably of their declining skill level, total output equal to the area under the curve. A country which employs units of labour right down to the bottom right-hand corner, to the very least productive, will maximise this area under the curve and thus maximise GDP. On the other hand, the country which cuts off the employment of the least productive labour, for instance via a minimum wage or trade union resistance to downward wage mobility or other forms of labour market inflexibility, will increase productivity per person employed or per hour worked, but at the expense of total output and indeed of unemployment. And that, as the Americanists would say, is precisely what France has done. That France's high productivity per hour worked looks less impressive once you get to GDP per capita as a result, in the middle column, of much lower hours worked per person. And of course, there is quite a lot in that. France's high productivity is, to a degree, I believe, at the expense of high unemployment. Though again, with a few important counter-caveats. First, it is noticeable that even after these adjustments for hours worked, France and Germany still do better than the UK in per capita income, which means that their area under the curve on the previous chart is higher despite cutting off the tail of low-skilled, low-income labour, so that their whole schedule, the level of the line, must be at a superior level. Secondly, that in assessing the performance of a country with fewer hours worked but higher productivity per hour worked, we must distinguish whether the non-working hours were unused voluntarily or not. By which I mean this, that if you had a country which had the same involuntary level of unemployment as another, but had through free choice selected a different trade-off between leisure and income, whether via differences in, say, retirement ages, female participation rates, or hours worked, then if that country had a higher productivity per hour worked than the other country, it would, in some meaningful sense, be more productive, even if its GDP per capita was lower. I.e., if the conditions on the left-hand box apply, then country A, with higher productivity per hour, is in some sense, and I think in a very clear sense, a superior economic performance than country B, even though it has a lower GDP per capita. That lower GDP per capita simply following from free choices about leisure income trade-offs. Which is simply to say that GDP per capita is no more an absolute and valid measure of economic success than output per hour worked. And if we must avoid the fallacy of lauding an economy which maximizes output per hour at the expense of involuntary unemployment, we should equally be wary of assuming that more labor inputs are by definition good as long as they produce any marginal product. For that would be a very odd proposition. It would be very odd proposition in terms of economics. A positive desire to maximize inputs sitting ill with a science whose usual focus is the maximization of outputs, but the minimization of inputs. And a strange proposition in social terms, a relentless desire to maximize income, not balanced by any sense of trade-off between leisure hours and income. But I think it is a proposition to which some Americanists seem committed when they point to France's low hours worked per person as by definition a form of economic failure. Low hours per person are only a form of economic failure if their unemployment of the extra hours is involuntary. If they are voluntarily not worked, they represent simply a different social choice on the leisure versus income trade-off. And I suspect that the difference between French and American hours worked almost certainly entails both a significant involuntary and a significant voluntary element. So where are we? Well, after the continentalists' pitch on productivity per hour, the Americanists' counterattack, and the continentalists' counter-caveats, we've established that neither productivity per hour worked, nor productivity per person employed, nor income per capita can be taken as an absolute measure of economic success. But it feels like some mix of these, along with a look at the level of involuntary unemployment, is what we're after. Output per hour worked, as long as not at the expense of involuntary unemployment. And the proposition that although maximizing average labour productivity by cutting off the low end of the labour supply curve is not superior, the position on the left here not superior to the position on the right, a higher labour productivity schedule is always better, i.e. for any given level of labour input, greater labour productivity is always preferable, whether or not the tail is cut off through labour market imperfections. But even here, the Americanists would not necessarily agree, for they have a second objection to a focus on labour productivity, which says that even maximising the labour productivity schedule is not necessarily optimal if it is achieved at the cost of unnecessary capital inputs, i.e. that we cannot even assume that Schedule A is better than Schedule B, independent of how much capital we use. That we need to look at capital productivity as well, and then combine capital and labour productivity into the ultimate measure, total factor productivity. And indeed, if we look at capital productivity, it does indeed vary quite significantly between our four countries, and as a result, if we compare their performance on a total factor productivity basis, we get a different relative ranking than when we look at labour productivity alone. On this basis, the US is the clear winner, and the UK is less far behind France and a bit less far behind Germany than previously supposed, but still well behind the US. The US, not the continent, should therefore, it is argued, be the model. So, is that right? Is capital productivity a relevant factor, and is total factor productivity an inherently better measure of performance than labour productivity? Well, the answer, like most things in this debate, is more of a mix of yes and no than polemicists on either side like to pretend. Clearly, ceteris paribus, higher capital productivity is a good thing. Capital represents past investment, which represents past consumption foregone, and we want to get as high a return as possible on any given amount of consumption foregone. So that, looking at the capital productivity schedule, which is analogous to the labour productivity schedule, but now with units of capital in declining return order on the horizontal axis, it must be the case that everything else being equal, Schedule A is better than Schedule B. And it is quite possible that the US is on a higher schedule than France or Germany, that it gets a higher return for any given amount of capital because, for instance, it utilizes its capital assets more intensively rather than using them, leaving them underutilized overnight or weekends. But it's also possible that the US has higher capital productivity not because it is on a higher schedule, but because it sets a higher cutoff point of investment return, increasing capital productivity but reducing labour productivity. And this slide is described the other way round, that if you decide to include in your capital the bit which represents the bottom right-hand corner, you will have low-return projects which increase output and labour productivity but reduce average capital productivity. And of course that might be an optimal thing to do, for it must be the case that right down in the right-hand corner of the schedule, you get at some point to an unattractively low return, but possible also that very low-return projects still go ahead in some countries, If, for instance, you have public sector entities making investments for prestige rather than return purposes, or private sector management able to pursue prestige rather than return due to the absence of effective shareholder control. And again, it is possible, indeed likely, that some of that may have occurred in, for instance, France, increasing attainable output and attainable labour productivity, but at such a cost in foregone consumption that it was not a rational economic choice, nor indeed a choice which individual French people would have made if they had been given the overt choice. But equally, it is possible that US capital investment has been constrained below a level which is in some sense optimal, for just as you can increase measured labour productivity by not employing the less productive units of capital, for instance via a minimum wage, so you can increase capital productivity by focusing on a small number of high return projects. So that, for instance, if the free market intersection of supply and demand curves for savings is at a point representing a value of investment A, A is actually missing here, but A is that point there, a government which successfully imposed a tax on investment returns would reduce the level of capital investment to B on this chart. It would, as a result, have a lower GDP per capita, lower labour productivity, but it would have higher capital productivity. And the same result could be achieved, not by a tax on investment returns, could be achieved if managers were excessively risk-averse or applied arbitrarily high hurdle rates because they took a short-term view, as in Will Hutton's attack on the Anglo-Saxon shareholder value model. So that, stepping back, higher capital productivity in the US could be either the result of better productivity for any given level of capital, i.e. a higher capital productivity schedule, or a cut-off point of the capital productivity schedule at what the continentalists claim is a suboptimal point. Investment too low to drive labour productivity to desirable levels. And the problem is that there is no definitive way of deciding what the rational or best point on the capital productivity schedule is. Obviously, there is some level of return on investment which is so low that it would be waste to pursue it. But as between, say, points A and B, there is no definitive worst or best, but an issue of social choice. If a country selects B, it will, everything else being equal, have higher capital productivity, but lower labour productivity and lower GDP capita. If it selects A, it will have lower capital productivity, but higher labour productivity and a higher GDP per capita. So capital productivity, like labour productivity, is important, but riddled with as many imperfections, and indeed riddled with the same imperfections. And you don't escape those imperfections by focusing on total factor productivity. Now, I read some press comment which seems to think that you do. They sort of pull out total factor productivity with a sort of flourish. The real measure, the true measure of productivity, inherently better than either labour productivity or capital productivity, and at last, the thing we must maximise, and no doubt about it. But I fear that those who latch on to total factor productivity in that way don't understand precisely what it is. It's a measure of relative productivity which asks how much of a total difference in output levels is explained by differences in labor or capital inputs, with any remaining difference being the difference in total factor productivity. And in absolute terms for a country, it can be calculated quite simply as the weighted average of labor and capital productivity, which means that TFP suffers from exactly the same deficiencies as both labor and capital productivity. Higher labor productivity is not by definition good because you can increase it by simply not employing your less skilled workers on the left. And higher capital productivity is not definitionally good because you can increase it by only picking a small number of high return projects by applying an unreasonably high hurdle rate. And total factor productivity, which can be represented as here on the vertical axis, while labor and capital form two horizontal axes, the schedule being a plane, not a line. You may need to use a bit of imagination here. My secretary spent a lot of time trying to represent a schedule in 3D space, but it is a plane which is a declining function of both increased labor and increased capital. The total factor productivity can be increased by either minimizing labor input or minimizing capital input. You can increase TFP by having a minimum wage which cuts off the employment of low-skilled labor by moving up this side of the plane. You can increase TFP by setting your hurdle rate high and minimizing capital investment. TFP doesn't rescue us from the conceptual problems of labor productivity and capital productivity. It actually suffers from both simultaneously. For any given combination of labor and capital, higher TFP is always better, i.e. the higher the plane, the better. But that's not the same as saying that a higher observed level of TFP is definitionally better, since the level of TFP reflects choice of position on the plane as well as the level of the plane. So TFP, contrary to many commentators, is not the perfect measure of absolute efficiency. Though what is almost certainly the case is that big differences in TFP almost certainly mean differences in absolute efficiency, and that trends in total factor productivity are likely to be fairly highly correlated to trends in absolute efficiency. Which means that there is in fact no definitive maximum in all of this debate. And step one in thinking clearly is to realize that fact, rather than to alight on the particular measure which happens to support one's ideological predilections. There is no absolute measure of success, and neither higher labor productivity, nor higher GDP per capita, nor higher capital productivity, nor higher TFP are necessarily, or in all conditions, good. And the actual, the observable relativities of capital intensity and capital productivity, of labor input and labor productivity, which we observe between countries, reflect not merely differences in absolute efficiency, but social choices about the trade-off between present and future consumption and between leisure and income. And we need to recognize that explicitly if we're to make valid comparisons. So much then for the theory. But what, with all due caveats, do the figures suggest about the relative performance of the four countries? Well, on the labour productivity per hour work basis, we've already seen the figures. Germany and France the leaders on a whole economy basis, France slipping a little, and the US rising when we look at market sector alone, the UK clearly behind on both measures. But with France and Germany making a very different social choice about number of hours worked than the UK and the US, with the result that on a GDP per capita basis, the US is the clear leader, and France and Germany are only about 5 to 15% ahead of the UK in prosperity. And a very different social choice, too, between France and Germany and the UK, and to a degree between France and Germany and the US on capital intensity, with Germany and France providing for each hour worked 30 to 40% more capital investment to the UK and about 10 to 15, 10 to 20% more than the US. Although achieving this greater capital investment a much lower rate of capital productivity, either because of lower absolute efficiency, a lower schedule, or because that extra capital involves taking on additional low-return projects going on right on down to the right-hand corner of the capital productivity schedule. So, a complex picture of different relative positionings on different measures, and one which I think can be best understood in terms of the following framework, which will distinguish between countries on three dimensions. In the top left-hand box, output for the same capital and labour input, i.e. absolute efficiency. In the middle box, capital intensity, a product of a combination of past prosperity and social choice about the level of investment. And in the bottom box, labour input per capita, a product of social choice. The first two combining to determine labour productivity and hours worked combining to produce GDP per capita. Comparing on this framework, first the US versus France and Germany, it seems highly likely that the US is somewhat ahead in terms of absolute efficiency. Now, we can't be absolutely definite on this, and we certainly can't be definite on the magnitude of the US advantage, because we don't actually have a macro measure of absolute efficiency. Total factor productivity, as I've said, is the nearest measure, but it's not a precise measure of absolute efficiency. But it is nevertheless a reasonable assumption that the US is ahead in absolute efficiency, both because micro level, sector by sector, company by company, case by case evidence suggests that, and because at the macro level, as shown here, France and Germany achieve only a 6 to 9% advantage on labour productivity, despite a 10 to 30% capital intensity advantage, which certainly implies that they are on a lower capital productivity schedule than the US, not just a different, more capital intensive point. The US absolute efficiency advantage may be quite small, it may be no more than 5 or at most 10%, but it probably is there. That absolute efficiency advantage is, however, offset by France and Germany's higher capital intensity, and capital intensity, of course, reflects two factors: past prosperity, the past level of income out of which investment was saved, and social choice, the level of the investment rate. Now, in this case of France and Germany's higher capital stock reflects a higher investment rate, since total income levels out of which to save have always been somewhat lower than in the US. Finally, in the bottom box, we bring in the other dimension of social choice. Hours worked, the US deciding to work 30 to 40%, really dramatic amount more per person, translating to a slightly lower 20 to 30% income advantage given France's slight advantage in labour productivity at the total economy level. In summary, therefore, the US absolutely more efficient than France and Germany, but with France and Germany choosing to invest more and work less. Using the same framework to compare France and Germany versus the UK suggests the following picture. The comparison of absolute efficiency unclear, though probably Germany and France slightly ahead. The UK 30 to 50% behind in capital intensity, reflecting past prosperity and investment rates. The UK therefore 20 to 30% behind in labour productivity, but offsetting that half of that advantage by working 10 to 20% harder. So similar absolute efficiency, more continental investment, more UK hours worked. And finally, and most simply, the UK versus the US, the US undoubtedly ahead in absolute efficiency, 20 to 30% more capital investment, and working 10 to 15% more hours per capita even than the British, with a resulting GDP per capita advantage of 35 to 40%. All of which, I think, suggests two fundamental questions. Why is the US ahead of both Britain and France and Germany in absolute efficiency? And why has Britain made different social choices than France or Germany in respect to levels of investment and hours worked? First then, why is the US ahead in absolute efficiency? Well, of course, part of the story is simply historic. The US was, for all sorts of reasons, well ahead of all European countries in the 1950s, and it simply takes time to catch up. Best practice transfer mechanisms across the world via ownership links, capital flows, copying, consultants providing ideas, benchmarking, all of those mechanisms are in the long run very powerful, but they simply take time. And part of the story is simply that Germany and France and the UK have been catching up with the US, but they haven't got there yet. But it is also noticeable from this slide that the pace of catch-up for France and Germany seems to have slowed down significantly in the last 20 years and perhaps stalled completely. And it is therefore possible, and I suspect likely, that there will exist into the future a small US absolute efficiency advantage, perhaps no more than 5%, certainly no more than 10%, which does not disappear through the process of catch-up. Why might that be? Well, I think the reasons are fairly obvious, for I think the US has two large and inherent advantages over the European economies which have a significant impact on productivity. The first is a very large single market, a market of 270 million people speaking the same language, with a more homogeneous culture than Europe, more homogeneous legal and accounting and tax systems, and one currency. And all of those factors, if you simply describe those factors, they must imply lower overheads and administrative costs as a percentage of end value added, greater economies of scale in production and marketing, in branding and selling, and increased competitive intensity and contestability of markets, putting greater pressure on management to improve performance. Now, I think it's very difficult to make any precise measure of the scale of the productivity advantage resulting, but I think it is also difficult to imagine that it would fail to produce an advantage of at least a few percentage points. The second inherent advantage is low population density, an economic factor which I'd like to suggest has received inadequate attention in productivity debates. Lower population density means a lower cost of land. It means you can use land more freely, either in manufacturing facility design or in retail outlets or in distribution. And it means that there is less public pressure against greenfield development and therefore less need for more expensive and difficult brownfield development. And those facts are bound to have a pervasive impact on absolute efficiency, on the output available from any given quantity of capital and labour. Retail and hotel operations which can be designed without space constraints are inherently more efficient because of better capital physical layout. It is simply more efficient to run a hotel built on a nice big greenfield site so that you lay out the restaurant next to the dining room than to run a hotel which is a brownfield, a hotel within an old historic building in a more dense centre of town. Less physical congestion in distribution, wider, more open roads, allows larger manufacturing plants and larger delivery volumes in larger trucks to larger retail stores. A key explanation, along with the large homogeneous market, of O'Mahony and Mason's finding that larger batch size, larger run length, is a significant factor in superior US manufacturing productivity. Less opposition to greenfield development makes it easier for new clusters of related economic activity to develop. And less opposition to greenfield development increases further the contestability of markets, particularly markets where local presence is particularly important, such as the retail sector. As with the large and homogeneous single market, it would be difficult or impossible to measure the impact of these factors precisely, but difficult to imagine the impact being less than several percentage points. So that if we are looking for an explanation of a US absolute efficiency advantage, an inherent and one which is not disappearing as a result of catch-up, of perhaps 5 to 50, 10%, I suspect the answers are staring us in the face. The combination of a large homogeneous single market and lower population density highly likely to produce an inherent advantage of that magnitude. The difficult question is not why the advantages are there, but what to do about them. And here we face two questions: whether it is desirable, whether it is possible to match the US advantage, and whether it is desirable. On the large homogeneous single market, the answer is surely that it is desirable as far as possible for us to match the US advantages. And that means completing the single market in Europe, removing remaining barriers to competition, aiming for more harmonized accounting and legal rules, and perhaps entering the single currency if we are convinced that the micro supply side benefits offset any macro risks. But as we do all that, I think we must be realistic that however hard we try, barriers of language and culture will still make the European single market less complete, less competitive, and less amenable to economies of scale than the US. We can go somewhat down the road, we should go as far as possible, but we simply can't replicate it entirely. On the impact of low population density, the question is both, is it possible and is it desirable? It is as much a question of social choice as of economic efficiency, by which I mean this. We cannot make ourselves less densely populated. Well, I suppose a really forceful government could, but on the whole that would not be politically acceptable. But we do make decisions about how we face the inevitable cost, the inevitable economic cost of population density. If we have a lax attitude to greenfield development, whether of roads or of retail stores or of housing, we will get somewhere what closer to replicating the conditions conducive to high productivity and to the formation of new business clusters that we see in the US, though it is unlikely that we could ever match them completely. But we would do so at the expense of an environmental impact which some would oppose. Now, we sometimes see that environmental impact in qualitative terms and indeed as somehow being essentially non-economic or non-rational, the sort of woolly green stuff. But actually, it is a real cost which sometimes takes measurable economic form. For instance, a decline in housing values produced by a nearby road development is a measure of that cost. And the fact that we do not have full compensation for falls in housing values when faced with a new development is a mechanism by which we make sure that the externality costs fall on a specific small number of people who own those houses rather than being borne by the general taxation. And NIMBYism is therefore not irrational non-economic behavior, but a perfectly rational economic motivation, an attempt to protect value via political pressures in a context where property rights cannot capture and are not compensated for the loss of environmental benefits, and where therefore a purely market-based approach to maximizing your individual value is not available. So we face a trade-off, a social choice, and the job of the economist is to illustrate social choice, not to deny it. So that one possibility, faced with at least part of the absolute efficiency advantage which the US enjoys, is simply to accept it as inherent, which would not be catastrophic. It does not mean accepting a lower rate of growth in productivity and prosperity from the current level. It does not constrain the UK from catching up productivity to at least the levels of the French and Germans, and that would imply growing above the US rate of increase for at least several years. And it is not a constraint on employment creation, since productivity and employment creation are two different challenges of economic policy, not the same and not correlated. But it would mean accepting a permanent US advantage in absolute efficiency of perhaps 5 percentage points, perhaps a bit more, implying a similar advantage in GDP per capita if all other factors were equal. And the role of the economist, as I've said, is to inform that choice with best estimates of magnitude, but not to imply that there is no choice. So much for the US comparison. The second question posed was why the UK has made such different social choices than France and Germany in respect to investment levels and hours worked. Again, it's important to start with an historical context, a context of improving relative UK performance. The UK's total factor productivity, which actually fell behind French and German levels from 1950 to 1980, has in fact caught up significantly in the last 20 years, reflecting a closing of the absolute efficiency gap with, I would suggest, privatization, better industrial relations, a reborn will to manage, inward investment bringing better management practice, and the impact of more intense European single market competition, all acting to increase UK absolute efficiency. And there's an important historical pattern too in relation to capital intensity, with, for instance, Germany's relative capital intensity advantage being the product not of higher investment rates in the last 15 years, but the product of higher investment rates in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and with that advantage now constant, or indeed slightly falling, since UK business investment as a percent of GDP is now slightly higher than either French or German, though government investment is still lower, the difference actually being much smaller than layout suggests, that we are now slightly ahead of those countries in business investment as a percent of GDP. So you could say that the problem is solved, and that the causes of higher German and French investment, the differences in social choice, now in a sense lie in the past. But I think it's still important to analyse why that difference occurred, not only as an exercise of economic history, but because the UK rate of investment still remains inadequate to close the capital intensity and productivity gap. For if the UK simply invests, as you can see it is roughly doing here, at the same rate, or only slightly above France and Germany and the US, the capital stock gap, while not growing in percentage terms, will simply stay stable. We need to go through a period of investing a higher percentage of GDP to close the gap. And if all other factors are equal, the free market equilibrium ought to produce that higher investment, because if skills, financial market behavior, and managerial attitudes are similar, and if there are efficient mechanisms for the transfer of both best practice and capital, a country with a currently lower productivity rate ought to attract a higher level of investment, since the opportunities for high return on investment should be greatest in that country. Now, the figures here suggest that we are beginning to see that effect, but it needs to go further if we are to close the gap. So I think it is important to understand why the historical difference, and as well as why the recent more favourable trend. So why has the UK had a lower tendency to invest than the continent? And why indeed, a perhaps related question, has it chosen or ended up with higher hours worked? Well, the answers are multifaceted and disputed, and I cannot in this lecture attempt any proof of a particular theory, but what I'd least like to do is set out a story which appears to fit both macro figures and micro-level anecdote. A story which involves complex cycles of self-reinforcing factors, both in the arena of macroeconomic and financial influences, and in respect to labour and capital market factor costs and incentives. In the macro and financial arena, I think it seems clear that for much of the post-war period, the UK macroeconomy was simply more volatile than major continental competitors, with more volatile rates of inflation and growth. And that volatility seems to have been both a cause and an effect in a cycle which involved more risk-averse short-termist behaviour, lower investment, lower growth, and higher inflation and volatile exchange rates as a result. Certainly, it was the perception of many in British business, it was very much the perception of the CBI in its policy statements, until about 5 years or so, that British business had been subject to so much macroeconomic uncertainty, booms and busts, that short-termism was the perfectly logical managerial reaction. The way I used to put it is that small companies which took the long-term attitude in 1990 weren't there in 1992. Those which were a bit more short-termist still survived. As for what the basic causes of that cycle were, the exogenous rather than the dependent variables, accounts differ. Will Hutton would argue that the relationships between finance and management created a short-termist culture independent of the macro volatility and that that was the exogenous variable. Others would focus on the issues of labor and capital cost, which I'm going to turn to in a minute. Some would say, and I would certainly believe there is a truth in this, that our late entry to the common market, failing to create competitive pressure for change and investment in the 1950s and 60s, was important. Some would simply say it was poor management and poor industrial relations, the classic sort of Corelli-Barnett view of British society set out in the Audit War. And others would simply say we were just very bad at macroeconomic policy implementation. Well, I'm not going to attempt in this lecture to judge between those competing explanations of which was the exogenous variables, but I would suggest that whatever the initial causes, it was the cyclical reinforcement of those factors which subsequently became crucial. Those macro and financial factors then interlocked, I would suggest, with characteristics of the labour and capital market, which made continental economies both more capital intensive and less labour intensive than the UK's. From the macro and financial factors that we saw on the previous page, and from higher levels of skills of the workforce, came higher continental productivity and higher real wages. And those then combined with two other forces to make continental decisions on capital versus labour substitution quite different from those we saw in the UK. One of those factors was continental tax systems, which had been strongly favourable to capital investment and strongly unfavourable to the employment of labour. And I think it is very important to realise that tax systems do make a difference. If you were French management over the last 20 years, facing the tax treatment of capital investment and the tax treatment of labour, the obvious thing is to invest like mad and to employ as little labour as possible. The other was labour market inflexibility, minimum wages set high, significant trade union power, restraints on firing labour, which made management averse to hiring it, different inflexibilities in different countries, but all overall tending to create a strong management preference for capital investment rather than labour input, creating higher investment and higher productivity, but also lower employment, both in terms of lower hours worked and higher unemployment. That picture fits both the macro facts and the micro level anecdotes. If you ask any UK car manufacturer with plants also in Germany why productivity per hour worked in the UK is lower, you will usually get two responses: low skills and lower capital investment. Ask them again why that same company has invested less in the UK than in Germany, because it's the same company, subject to the same relationship with shareholders, using the same hurdle rates. And part of the answer will typically be that higher German wages and the danger of high exit costs from employment if you get it wrong mean that when you are thinking of expanding, the investment case for labour minimising investment always looks better in the German plant than it does in the British plant. If you ask a multinational company which has numerous product lines which they manufacture in the UK and the continent and trying to decide which to put in their continental plants, which to put in the UK, the pattern is often explained by this cycle and then contributes to this cycle. Long batch run, high volume lines in highly automated continental plants, shorter runs and products requiring more frequent line changes and more labour input in less capital intensive UK plants. A product of this cycle, but also contributing to it. I think this point can be illustrated by an anecdote which I've told, and I'm told it is a true anecdote. If not, it's one of those apocryphal stories which we should assume it's true, because it's fun to assume it's true, which is that at some stage in the late 80s, Margaret Thatcher was meeting with a large number of industrialists involved in both the UK and the continent, and she said to them, well, isn't it great? We have created this incredibly flexible labour market for you. You have lower wages in the UK. There is no limit to the downward flexibility of wages. There is just a totally flexible environment. And in the continent, you've got the other problem. You've got
high real wages and inflexibility. And of course, that means, doesn't it, that you're going to invest your marginal euros, or whatever the currency was, in the UK, not the continent. To which someone replied, well, we are very thankful for these conditions, Mrs. Thatcher, but you have to realise that one of the consequences of it is that at the margin, investment in Germany looks more attractive than investment in the UK, precisely because of some of the high wage costs and rigidities which we attempt to overcome by high levels of investment. Now, of course, that suggests that the continental model has downsides, that its higher productivity may well have been at the inevitable cost of higher unemployment, with the social choice of lower German and French hours worked being part involuntary as well as part voluntary. That is an example, again, of the trade-offs involved in this area of policy, raising some complex questions about optimal policy, questions, however, which I will have to leave for another day, since the time has definitely come to sum up. My aim in this lecture has been to explore some of the complexities involved in this debate on productivity, and to illustrate that the choice of optimal policy cannot assume either one self-evidently correct maximand nor a sole path to achieve that objective. We are not just dealing with absolute efficiency, but with social choice. I started with two potential models which different protagonists claim the UK should pursue. The US model has an advantage of higher absolute efficiency. The continental model, higher investment in capital and in skills, though I have not investigated the skills issue in any detail. I have suggested some of the reasons for that higher capital absolute efficiency in the US and for higher capital investment on the continent. And that analysis suggests some common and agreed measures to enhance UK productivity, but also some choices. It implies that whichever attitude you take, measures to make the European single market as complete and as deep as possible, measures to make product markets as competitive as possible, will help us to narrow, though not eliminate, the absolute efficiency gap between the UK and the US, and indeed between the continent and the US. And the figures show that increased capital investment is essential to closing the productivity gap, and therefore they illustrate the vital importance of macroeconomic stability of government capital investment. But beyond that common core, the analysis also suggests some choices and trade-offs. The continental model implying still further capital investment, higher capital investments and skills investment, but raising questions about whether there are any policy levers to encourage capital investment in a global market, and raising questions about whether and how the continental high investment model can be made compatible with full employment. Or the US model implying physical deregulation, easier planning rules, but with questions about how much of the gap we would close via that route and whether it is desirable. Both choices can be informed by economic analysis, but they are choices, and choices which should be debated, not hidden by the assumption that there is one correct measure of economic success or one correct route to achieve it. Thank you very much.
Well, I think that was a fantastic lecture, I must say. Incredibly ambitious and wide-ranging and very successful and profound. We now have a chance to say if we agree or disagree. Yes.
Will be changed if one brings in various degrees and types of government intervention. Intuitively, I would have thought, for example, that it should be possible with appropriate government intervention to get much nearer to full employment, as I believe the present government is trying to do. And also, as I was also to stop the effect, which is very noticeable in this country, for example, whereby those who are in employment work much longer hours. And surely this way would be to reduce the hours worked by the top those in work to enable more people actually to do constructive work.
Thank you very much. I think it's better to comment as we go along.
We go along.
Yeah.
Well, as I said in passing, as we went along, I actually think that the issue of how you create full employment is a distinct issue from how you create higher productivity. Some people tend to talk about the two together, and they use concepts of external traded competitiveness to link the two, but I think that is an economic delusion, that there are essentially two problems of economic policy: how to maximize the productivity of those people employed, and how to ensure that there is no involuntary unemployment, which is not the same as how to maximize the number of hours worked. It is how to produce a low level of involuntary unemployment. And on the creation of employment, I do believe that the fundamental issue is the effectiveness of the labor market. I mean, I think if you want to have a high level of employment, you require levels of skills which ensure matches between demand and supply, and you need flexibility of skills, but you also need the avoidance of inflexibilities, which can be of the nature of minimum wages set too high, or of excessive degrees of trade union power, or various other forms of inflexibility. And I actually think that if you look at the reasons why our unemployment is now significantly lower than France or Germany's, I think it does have quite a lot to do with the decentralized labor market which we created during the course of the 1980s. So I do not see the pursuit of full employment as it were, the bit of this which requires government intervention. I think the level of skills, which is an essential element of labour market flexibility, involves a significant role for governments. I think it involves government intervention in one sense, which we do have, which is that if you want to combine full employment with reasonable levels of income at the low skill, low productivity end, it is very sensible to use in-work benefits to allow, broadly speaking, wages to be close to their market clearing level, but to pursue social objectives via things like the working family tax credit. And that is an important intervention. It's not an important intervention to people who don't care about how low incomes are at the low end, but it is an important intervention. It would be one to me for those who do care but want to combine it with a high level of employment.
Next. Can I follow that up, Ada? I mean, I've always thought that, and what is one trying to do in these comparisons? You're really trying to say who is the most prosperous. I mean, it's not really about performance, it's about prosperity. And that means something like income per head, but it doesn't mean income per head because there's voluntary non-participation. So it means something like income or output, which is the same thing, per unit of labor supplied. So it seems to me it's
is basically what you have, your output per man-hour worked, adjusted for the man-hours which people would like to have worked and are not managing to get an income for. And that would tend to come more down. I mean, given that the unemployment differences are not that huge, you're talking about 5%, not 30%, that would tend to come down more on the side of the continentalists than the side of the Americanists.
Well, Richard, I had no idea which side you were going to come down on. Yes, I agree with you, but I'd like to make a distinction which I put in a few paragraphs that I omitted for the purposes of time. I think if we were trying to measure right now, prosperity now, you know, how rich an economy is in this year, then really we should look at two factors. We should look at productivity per hour worked, i.e. how much are we getting out, prosperity per hour, how much are we getting out for the input of work, and we should then also think, however, about the problem about involuntary hours worked. We should check that against the involuntary element of the hours work. I mean, I think if you were trying to measure prosperity directly and you could be confident in the two countries that you were comparing that they have the same involuntary level, then it is prosperity per hour work, which is the measure of prosperity now. However, there is also an important point then to make. That it's not necessarily a measure of efficiency, in the sense, you know, that investment, that capital is there because somebody in the past didn't consume, right? They gave up a present level of prosperity in the past to become more prosperous now. And in a sense, therefore, it is valid for, as it were, the Americanists to say, well, France has achieved this high level of productivity per hour worked at a high level of sacrifice in terms of the consumption standard of living in 1987 and 1980. And therefore, in a sense, I think you do have to think about it in both those ways. You have to think about whether it was efficient for them to, as I put it, go right on down to the bottom right-hand corner of the capital investment schedule. That is a valid thing to think about, and it may not have been a rational choice. But having made it, they are more prosperous, which is why there are different measures as to whether you are trying to say whether what the French economy has done was a rational optimization of consumption levels of all different French people over the 20 years at different time periods versus a maximization of French prosperity now. So the possible answer is that in some sense the multi-period French economy has not maximized French prosperity. But right now, I think you're right, productivity per hour worked is the best single measure of productivity now, given that the previous savings, the previous foregone consumption, is water under the bridge, and therefore irrelevant to the present comparison.
What puzzles me in your analysis, in other places, is
sorry, can you grab that? Is it turned on? What puzzles me in your analysis is why the involuntary level of unemployment, which appears to be a pretty key thing to know about, remains an unknown variable in your equation. It seems to me that unless one has a viewpoint about the level of involuntary unemployment, then one can reasonably say, well, this is all a matter of social choice and we can't decide because we don't know what this level of involuntary unemployment is. But surely we must have some clues as to what the level of involuntary unemployment is, and therefore some clues as to the relative trade-offs that are being made.
No, I do agree with that. I didn't want to imply that we don't know the level of involuntary unemployment. I mean, they are imperfect measures, but I think things like claimant unemployment or ILO definition unemployment are not bad measures of involuntary unemployment. I just wanted simply to suggest that if you take lower French hours worked per capita than the US and take that comparison, an element of that is involuntary unemployment and an element is probably voluntary, right? Now, if I were Richard, and making the continentalist point, I would say the Americans are working 35% more hours. I know that their unemployment rate is 5% less than the French. Therefore, of the 35% less hours, 5% is involuntary and 30% is voluntary. Therefore, you know, looks like, you know, we should focus on that productivity per hour worked improvement of France as being pretty game, set, and match. I think the difficulty is that there may be an element of involuntary beyond the unemployment rate. I think probably the difference in the unemployment rate gives us the minimum level for the difference in involuntary hours work, but it is an open question as to whether beyond that there are French people who would have preferred more hours work and more income, or people who are simply inactive in the French labour market and who don't show up in the unemployment figures. So that's where the complexity comes in. But I think what you mustn't do is leap to the other extreme, which I think the Americanists sometimes do, which is to say that the whole of this shortfall is by definition involuntary, which ends up, as I said, with a slightly absurd proposition by which one of the aims of economic policy is to maximize an input, and which completely fails to allow for the possibility that people might choose to work less hours as they become more prosperous.
Two. Machine, two.
Just to carry on with this voluntary, involuntary question. I think that you have to be a bit careful here because if the as many continental European countries do have a tax and benefit system which encourages older people not to work, then their not working is clearly voluntary in the sense that they have every incentive not to work. And now if you compare them with a country which doesn't provide these incentives, older people will work more in such a country.
And so you've got this difference. Now, whether you want to say this difference is a bad thing or not a bad thing is a slightly more delicate question than just the issue of whether people are unemployed voluntarily or not. Because much of the difference between how much work is done here compared to there, the difference between the incentives to work here and there, and much of that is a direct consequence of government policy. I think all I can say is I agree entirely, Stephen. Behind you. Among the reasons that explain the huge capital intensity in France, Germany, compared to Britain, you didn't mention one that seems to me important, and this is the reconstruction of Germany after the Second World War, and the will of the French government to intervene in and constructing motor roads, a huge investment drive in this sense. So I think, and maybe Britain living off its capital accumulated since the mid-19th century.
I think that is a fair... I think it's a fair point. I think when you have an inherited capital structure, which has not been, as it were, totally flattened by the Luftwaffe or the RAF, rather than being totally flattened, as the German was, you at least have the option of not investing, whereas if your capital structure has been totally flattened, you clearly have to invest. And I mean, this is classic Corelli-Barnett stuff. I think that probably is an explanation of part of the difference. And I suspect also that you are right, that high levels of French investment probably were driven, at least for a period of time, by a sort of an Etatist Gaullist approach to investment, which, as it were, was relatively indifferent to where you were on that capital schedule, and said, we're going to digitalize France Telecom in the 1970s, or we're going to build 2GB lines, wherever we are on that capital productivity schedule. Now, of course, the danger of that is that with that lack of discipline, you can end up doing some incredibly low return things. Which in terms of the return to the French people for their foregone consumption are not very attractive things to do. And of course, if you take more extreme cases, it's clear that if you misallocate massively, like communist regimes, high levels of investment seem not only not to give you return, but seem also to sort of undermine basic disciplines to an extent that they're positively harmful. But I think I would agree with you that those two factors, if you go back to the 50s and 60s, are probably ones which ought to be part of the picture.
Well, I would like to ask that about the arguments that you have explained, that explain the advantage of the US over Europe, like a big single market, an homogeneous culture, and
low population density, to which extent these arguments depend on the scale of the economies, because maybe they cannot apply to explain the differences within Europe between France and Netherlands or France and Sweden.
No, but I think if we look at France and the Netherlands, France and Sweden, I don't think we have all that much different. I mean, I didn't put in the Netherlands and Sweden, but I was reckoning that several of these continental countries are similar. I mean, I think you'd find for almost all continental countries some level of absolute efficiency disadvantage vis-a-vis the US. Once you get to small countries, of course, you have an effect which really confuses this analysis, which is once you're at a country of 60 million or so, for all that we talk about comparative advantage in different sectors, the structure of the economy is rather similar. I mean, it has roughly the same amount of retail and roughly the same amount of hotels, roughly the same amount of education and health and service sector, manufacturing sector. Not entirely true. I mean, Germany has more manufacturing. Once you get to small countries, you can have high levels of productivity or prosperity which are about the fact that that has a sectoral focus. I mean, I think if you now go to countries like Finland, you actually have the ability of the economy to make a real level of focus on, for instance, the electronic sector, the great success of the Finnish mobile phone sector, and you get differences which come from industry sectoral focus and selection, which almost by definition disappear once you get to continental level, because once you get to a continental level, economies are very similar. So I think once you get to, you know, each country in Europe, you will start getting some of those things confusing the analysis. But I think on average, you will still get this, you'll still on average get an absolute efficiency disadvantage vis-a-vis the US. Though of course it will vary. I mean, French retailing is almost as productive as the US, and it's physically the same. French retailing is whacking great sheds in out-of-town locations because France has a lower population density and therefore can allow unrestricted greenfield site development of retail space. I mean, so, you know, and equally within the US, I mean, there's what goes on in the less densely populated areas, and, you know, New York is not an undensely populated area. So one's talking about averages, and within each you'll find internal variations as well as variation between the two. But I think overall the distinction is still important.
I think we should release Adair at this point. He's just got back from Bolivia. I remember Sam Britton saying to me once, there are two kinds of economics. We know, don't we? There's economists' economics and there's businessmen's economics. And you and I know which is best, don't we? And I said, yes. What is extraordinary about Adair is that he is a businessman who understands and largely does economists' economics, and I think that the combination is really very, very powerful, because most economists don't have that reality element in their thinking that Adair, I think, brought in the second part of his lecture. I think this is going to be a very, very interesting book, which this is a foretaste, Adair, and we really look forward to having you with us for longer after New Year's Day, and thank you very, very much.